At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hello from the Heartland. My name is Jenna, and this is Smarter News. News when it matters and why it matters. Our Smarter series features unique people who help us think and live smarter. Tens of millions of children attend school in America every year. About 60 million kids attend K through 12th grades, and another approximately 20 million people will attend college, which means about one in four people in America are students. And figuring out how to safely return to school during the COVID-19 pandemic is really a puzzle. It's important not just for kids, by the way, but for the community overall. And that's why I really wanted to speak to our next guest, who, along with her team, has developed a model to try to estimate COVID-19 cases in schools. And I'm not going to go much further because I actually would like her to explain it because it's a really nice honor and privilege to have her. Professor Lauren Myers is at the University of Texas, Austin. One of her areas of expertise is to uncover the social and biological drivers of epidemics and build tools to help us all track and mitigate viral threats, which sounds ideal at this time. Professor Myers, tell us a little bit. You actually lead a team that's really focused on COVID-19. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. And thank you for having me today. I lead something called the University of Texas COVID-19 Modeling Consortium, and it's dozens of researchers that come from many different disciplines that are all united in the effort to bring the best data, bring the best science, bring the best models to the decision makers at the front line who are charged with keeping our communities, keeping our students, keeping our cities safe and healthy.
How did you get into this line of work?
So I have been an epidemic modeler and a pandemic modeler for over two decades. I started my career as a math major and a philosophy major in college. In graduate school, I studied biology. And then as a postdoctoral researcher, I happened into a project where I assisted the CDC in helping them figure out how to control outbreaks of respiratory diseases in nursing homes. And that sort of opened up the world to me of using math to help solve problems around infectious diseases, helped us to figure out where are they spreading today around the world, where might they be spreading tomorrow or next month, and most importantly, how do we use limited or costly resources to slow their spread and save lives?
Wow, this has been an incredible time for everybody, but I can't imagine to have your background and see this pandemic emerge. And by the way, not just a mathematical biologist, but you're also a mom. So what have the last few months been like for you?
Yeah, the last few months have been extremely, to be honest, difficult, stressful, and somewhat surreal. And I think it's true for everyone, you know, not just the epidemiologists in the audience. I've been thinking about viruses, deadly viruses, epidemics, pandemics, my whole career. I've done modeling during the SARS-1 threats of 2003, 2004, the H1N1 pandemic of 2009. I've worked with policymakers who are combating the Ebola epidemics in West Africa, Zika a few years ago. But this is the first threat that really has upended life as we know it, really hit close to home. I feel like I've been called to duty, right? That my students, my postdocs, my colleagues, myself, and we really have been working around the clock just to do everything we can to figure out what's going on with this threat and to support decision makers, our community leaders, and helping protect us all.
So how did you come up with this idea for the model? And I'm just speaking about it generically. This is a model that you were able to put together to predict or anticipate, I bet you use better words than I do, the number of COVID cases that could be in different schools of different sizes. How did that idea even come about?
So we have been talking to schools and principals and parents of school children who have all been trying to just understand what is the nature of the risk, what can they do to mitigate the risk. And the way we have sort of come to think about it is to really break down the challenge into three different types of risk. One is, you know, as we begin to bring students and teachers back to school, back on campuses, what is the chance that one or more of them will show up infected? They have been infected in the community, at home, and they come to school infected. Number two, if students, teachers do come to campus infected, what is the chance that they'll actually spread the virus to other people while at school? And then the third part is, if schools do turn out to be a place of transmission, to what extent will opening schools make things worse for the community as a whole? To what extent will transmission that happens at school actually amplify transmission in the community as a whole and lead to more cases, more hospitalizations, more deaths in the surrounding cities? And so this model that we developed really just helps to think through that first risk, the risk that one or more students or teachers will show up on day one or on week one infected. And the thing that's really important to realize, and that this model helps us to quantify, is that that risk very much depends on the state of the pandemic in the local community. For communities that have done a good job at repressing transmission, of enacting social distancing and face mask measures, of adhering to those measures to the point that really the cases have dropped to very low numbers, it's going to be much more feasible and probably much more safe to begin to cautiously bring kids to campus. It's just much less likely in those communities that somebody will be infected and then come to school infected. However, in communities and cities and states where we have had large summer waves of transmission, and where they're still battling to bring those waves under control, it's going to be riskier. It's going to be much more likely that one or two or even 10 students or teachers will show up in the very first week of school infected.
How local is a question when it comes to caseload. You know, I'm from San Francisco. It's a smallish big city. And depending on the different districts or different neighborhoods, you might have really different dynamics at play. So to accurately anticipate it, what does that mean? How local do you need to be?
Yeah. So transmission can be very local. You can, you know, literally have high levels of prevalence on one side of the railroad track and low levels on the other side, just depending on the makeup of the population, who's coming into contact with whom, who is having, you know, to go to work to make a living, and who can afford to stay home. And so you can have very small pockets of low risk and high risk. However, the difficulty is we don't necessarily have data at that high resolution, at that granularity, to really pick out which neighborhoods, in which neighborhoods or which school districts is it more feasible? Is it safer to bring kids to campus than others? You know, in many cases, as we're trying to look for data around the country to help us understand risk, often the most granular data that we have is at the level of counties. And there can be quite a bit of unseen heterogeneity within counties that we just can't pull out from the data that are available.
I understand. I know we're all sort of scrambling for numbers. We are here at Smarter News. I can't imagine what it's like when you're looking at these numbers and actually wielding them in really powerful ways. So what did you find at building this model? What are some kind of the big things that you learned?
So if you look at the maps that we've created using this model, and you know, these are maps of the entire United States, imagine, you know, bright red where there is a high chance that kids and teachers will show up at school infected, and you know, and white where there's no one going to show up at school infected, or very unlikely that even one person would show up in the school infected. You see very strong geographic patterns where the Sun Belt states in California, where we've heard reports or maybe even experienced firsthand waves of transmission that have led to increasing numbers of hospitalizations and deaths. In those states, it's still there's still wide community spread, and high likelihood that one or more people will show up at school infected. In the Northeast, we see what looks like much more promising signs, that it's much lower expectations for the number of people that will show up at schools infected. And really importantly, the risk that somebody is going to show up in a group infected depends not only on how much disease there is in your neighborhood or in your county or in your state, but it really depends on how many people are actually going to be getting together. So the risk is going to be much higher if you have a school of 500 students than if you have a school of 100 students. Basically, there'll be five times the chance that someone will show up infected if the school is five times bigger.
So I just want to explain this to some of our listeners who may not able to see the map at exactly the same time. What's so cool about this interactive map is you can see what it looks like in your area, depending on if your child is maybe attending a pod of 10 children or a school of 100 or a school of 500. And I'm wondering how you see your model being used to either guide, you know, professionals in education or even just families.
Yeah, well, let me pick up on your mentioning of a pod of 10 in case your listeners don't understand what that means. So a pod of 10, this is one of the strategies that's being discussed widely to ensure a safe reopening of schools. You know, if you do have 100 kids or 200 kids in your schools, the idea is that you should restrict the number of students and teachers that each student comes in contact with. Instead of being able to bump into all 99 other people in the school, you restrict the groups so that individuals are interacting with, you know, no more than 10 or no more than 15 other people. This is also called cohorting. And while a school of 500 may still have to worry about all 500 people, you as an individual or your child as an individual who's only interacting with 9 other people or 10 other people only has to really worry about whether or not those other 9 or 10 people are infected. So that's a way to sort of manage the risk to individuals, reduce the chance that any individual will encounter somebody who is infected, or if they themselves are infected, it'll reduce the number of people that they could possibly infect. And it also just makes responses and containment much more manageable. If a school does open up and eventually have a student or teacher arrive infected and identify them, they can more strategically, more in a more targeted way, quarantine or isolate subgroups without completely disrupting the school week and the education of their community. So pods and or cohorts are an effective way to manage that risk. And the maps help us visualize that change in risk. The likelihood, you know, that somebody will show up in a pod of 10 infected is very low all over the country, whereas the likelihood that somebody will show up infected in a school of 500 turns out to be quite high, particularly in the southern parts of the United States. So the goal with the map is really just to help people understand the risk and how podding can help minimize the risk, how the size of the school impacts the risk, how different parts of the country are experiencing different levels of risk, so that schools can make informed, data-driven decisions about when and how to safely bring kids and teachers back into school, back onto campus. It's also meant to help inform the public, to help parents understand the risks as they're trying to navigate decisions about whether to opt for online or in-person or hybrid options for their children. So it's really meant to make the data, make the risk more understandable to the country. And the other thing that this map can do, if people take a look at it and return to it occasionally through time, is you can also see how this risk changes through time. You know, as some of the southern states that have experiencing large waves, as they begin to bring those waves under control and they begin to see the numbers decrease, you know, move in the right direction, the risks are going to decrease and the feasibility of opening schools is going to increase.
As a mom, how do you feel about your children going back to school?
Yeah, as a mom of children in Texas, right now I'm very much on the fence about whether I would send my kids back to school when schools begin to open, because I'm in an area that still looks pretty red. I'm in an area where there still is a reasonable chance that if they open schools tomorrow, that there would be, you know, at least one student or teacher show up to school infected. But I also know that that risk is changing, that, you know, fortunately in my community, we are seeing the numbers of cases and numbers of hospitalizations and deaths declining. And so, you know, I'm hoping that by the time schools feel like it's safe to bring kids back to campus, that I will also feel that it's safe. But I also think that when we feel, you know, as I mentioned earlier, there are three parts to this risk, right? You know, how is somebody going to show up infected? Might they spread disease to someone else at school if they do show up infected? And then what happens in the community, you know, outside of school? That second part, that, you know, what happens if and when someone shows up to school infected? The more we can do to cohort, you know, limit the number of kids and teachers that every student interacts with, the more we can do to ensure that children and teachers keep a safe distance, the more we can do to require face masks and encourage and make it possible to wear face masks. And the more we can do to encourage people to stay home if they have even the mildest symptoms or believe they might have possibly been exposed to some of COVID, the better able we'll be able to prevent transmission in schools. So, you know, my decisions, you know, for my own children will depend on what's going on in my community in terms of how much COVID is spreading, and then what my schools are doing, what steps they're taking to ensure safety if and when we show up on campus.
I mean, there's so many different variables, right? As a parent, you're looking at so many different scenarios anytime. And by the way, that's something probably you share with scientists. we're all entertaining different parts of data to try to figure out, well, what do we want to do for our families? And as you mentioned, one of the things we looked at Smarter News this past week is the new information from the CDC about the more serious cases for children in COVID-19 in America. And what do those cases actually look like? And we know that there's a limit to those cases, but we used start seeing some information, you know, that there's maybe more of a prevalence in middle school to high schoolers. When do these cases get severe? And I'm just curious, when do you anticipate having the ability to get more granular with the data, whether it's staggered school schedules or the age of the child or whether or not the community has mask wearing inside the classroom?
So we may never be able to see at the level of individual schools what measures are being taken and how effective those are. I expect that in the months to come, there will be studies that look specifically at certain schools or certain communities and report those to, you know, to the rest of the world. So it really, I think, understanding generally you know, what the latest information is about how susceptible children are, how contagious they are once they become infected, understanding things like what our maps show, that risk really does depend on what's going on in the surrounding community and really does depend on how many other students and teachers your student is going to encounter in a typical day. Those things can help individuals to make, you know, the best, most informed decisions for themselves and for their families. And, you know, as of now, I mean, there certainly still is uncertainty about how susceptible children are and how infectious they are when they're infected. But what's becoming clear is that children certainly do get infected. So, you know, it may be at a slightly lower rate in younger kids than in older kids or adults, but they are getting infected and they are occasionally getting very ill and they are spreading to others. And even, you know, a child may not directly spread the virus to somebody who has a high-risk condition, but they could be a link in a chain of transmission events that eventually reaches others in the community who are much more likely to end up in the hospital or die. So, you know, measures we take to protect ourselves, to protect our children, to protect our classmates, our students, they not only directly protect those individuals, but they protect other people that we care about in our communities who may end up being much more at high risk for serious outcomes.
Absolutely. And I have to really remind myself, because we've been in this kind of social distancing state for some time, that my children haven't been living quote unquote normal lives. We would be at the trampoline park several times a week. We would be at the Chick-fil-A, you know, playground, rolling around in things that we shouldn't be rolling around in. And we're not doing that now. So it'll be interesting to see as we try to return, you know, what kind of emerges from there. Did you ever bring your children to the Chick-fil-A playground every once in a while. Professor Myers is it's been a long time.
I've never explored that one, but we used to love Chuck E. Cheese.
I bet they have very similar viral loads that we. that's a whole separate conversation. This is the final question here. Yeah, I'm sure there's a million questions you could try to answer on COVID-19 when it comes to transmission and any other kind of angle to this story. What is the next most interesting question that you would really like to answer or would like to at least focus on?
So in my modeling consortium, schools and safely opening schools is just one of many challenges that we are trying to tackle with our models. We are talking to universities about how to safely bring students back to campus. We are starting to think ahead to if and when vaccines become available, how we can prioritize them to not only protect people who are directly vaccinated, but to as quickly as possible protect communities as a whole. So we're thinking about everything from, you know, figuring out how to get kids to school in 2 weeks to how are we going to end this pandemic as quickly as possible once those medical countermeasures become available.
Well, we look forward to staying in touch. I can't wait to see, you know, the next iteration of your research. This has been incredibly valuable, and we really appreciate it, Professor Myers. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Stay safe, stay healthy.
Quick, concise, nonpartisan, smarter news, a refuge from the storm. I'm Jenna. Thank you for choosing smarter.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.